This is the Farm to Table Talk podcast, and I'm your host, Roger Wasson. A few years ago, Sacramento declared itself to be the farm-to-fork capital. It was a bold claim and was immediately challenged by other communities who felt that they deserved to be the capital. And some jumped on social media to say, oh yeah, we're just as good or better. Well, let that competition begin, because everybody wins if cities all over strive to be outstanding in this field. To shed light on the reasons and methods and results of becoming a leader in Farm to Fork, we gather during the Sacramento Farm to Fork Festival Week at one of the leading Farm to Fork restaurants, Mulvaney's B&L, with an enthusiastic audience. Banjo, fiddle music, food, wine, and an outstanding panel, including Rich Collins, farmer, founder of California Endives, past chairman of California Alliance with Family Farms, Allison Harvey, chef de cuisine at Ella's Dining Room, and also one of the chefs at the Bridge Dinner, Santana Diaz, the executive chef, food and nutrition service with UC Davis Health, and Bobbin Mulvaney, the co-owner chef of Mulvaney's B&L. A lively conversation and questions from a well-informed audience follows this little taste of banjo fiddle music. Like 100,000 people are going to be wandering down on the Farm to Fork Festival. And they're going to be down on the street and roaming down and standing in line to get a sandwich and a beer and so forth. And not very many conversations take place. Why are we even doing this in the first place, and how did this all come to be, and what's this mean to Sacramento? And we thought, well, you know what that had to happen is that we should try to have a smaller group, have some people together in a conversational situation, and this is very conversational. We're getting very conversational today. So we're going to do it tonight. I don't want to start off with Bobbin Mulvaney. Bobbin.
I'm Irish, and I don't let the truth get in the way of good stories, so the numbers may or may not be right. I think we moved in here about 15 years ago in the old firehouse, and we actually were running catering out of there, and we quickly got outed because Patrick kept saying he was opening a new restaurant, and actually got publicized. So we really opened the B&L in about 3 weeks' time, got it up and going. So for those of you who remember those days, it was a bit shanty Irish. One of our first chefs is sitting back here. And when Patrick told me he didn't want to have menus, he just wanted people to come in and tell him what he wanted to cook as an operations person, I'm like, oh, God, no. And I thought, well, we'll do one big chalkboard. And then I realized, well, yeah, that's really stupid. People can't read it, and I can't carry this big chalkboard around. But I understood what he was trying to sell, because our community had been trying to do it now about 20 years now, but had been trying to educate ourselves and others about eating and living in a farm to fork lifestyle. And what that means is that we really don't live four seasons here. We pretty much about every 3-6 weeks, food is changing here all the time, and we've got to keep up with it. So we had that restaurant open about a year, and our auto garage came available here. And the reason it is called Next Door is because we couldn't decide on a name, and it is Next Door. The place just became its own place, and it's our third child, so we just let it be.
Then I started talking to them, and they started talking about these other great chefs in town, and the ones that they really respect, like Brad out here at Cannon, and also with Allison, that we're going to have Allison involved in the program, and some other chefs in Santana, and also farmers. And one of the farmers that came up early in the conversation was Rich Collins. And so as a result, I went out to visit with Rich. And Rich gave me some books. And Rich, I'm going to have you explain that. But Rich was one of you, you were the founder of the Endive Association. You were the chairman of the California Alliance with Family Farmers. And you are just a champion of
farm to fork from a farm perspective, and a fan and a supporter and encourage. And I'm going to ask you a word or two here, because you also, currently you're growing asparagus seeds, but you've also been able to help other people get started farming too. I want you just to explain maybe a little bit of that adventure and your kind of commitment to getting people started in farming, and then I'm going to have you explain the books.
Okay. Well, I'm from Sacramento, from Carmichael. I'm not from a farm family. I started farming vegetables as a 10-year-old in Carmichael when my father purchased a 2-acre parcel. I always wanted to be a farmer. I remember driving by a farmer's insurance office on Arden Way when I was 5 or 6. I was, of course, a passenger. And I thought to myself, I saw the sign, I said, wow, there must be farmers in there. And I thought, how great is that? They do their own insurance. And anyways, I grew vegetables as a kid. In 1978, I was able to start growing Belgian endive after discovering it as a dishwasher here in Sacramento as a at a French restaurant called Restaurant La Salle. Went to UC Davis, ended up going to Europe for a year in 1982, came back and started growing endive in 1983. And have subsequently retired from that company. After about 35 years, I had had enough of the Belgian endive world. And my wife and I were able to purchase a farm between Davis and Dixon, where we now live, and is where I produce hybrid asparagus seed. But in the interim, I'm also quite involved with the local ag community in fostering better stewardship of water and soil resources. And also helping young farmers get started. We do have 4 young farmers on our property where we live, because when I started farming, not in the 70s in Carmichael, but when I started growing endive, I was helped by a very, very large farmer in the Elmira-Vacaville area. He had 5,000 acres. We farmed 5. And I was an absolute pain in the rear for him, because 5 acres is nonetheless is a big distraction with all the things that have to get done in a timely manner. So it was very important for us to pay it forward. With regards to the books, my mother knew I wanted to be a farmer. And in about 1971, she purchased this book for me called Malabar Farm. The only reason she purchased it is because the word farm was in the title. She knew nothing about it. And it was written by Louis Bromfield, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, perhaps America's most famous farmer in the mid-40s, late 40s, back in Ohio. So Roger has some books that there are some door prizes tonight. He was a great writer, but he was also a great agriculturalist and professed a way of life that's very, very relevant, not only then, but today. With regards to community, environment, and all that.
I tell you, talk about how you can remember somebody. A lot of times you press a business card into their hands, but you know, when you go out to see Rich, you walk out with this a book, you know, an old book, and I mean, it's like it stuck with me, and you got one too. Yeah. How many have books from Rich? Well, a couple more in there. I got good news for you. There's going to be 3 more pretty soon. I think what we're going to do is that when we open it up for questions, we'll say like the best question, the first 2-3 best questions are all going to get a book. Each one of them get a book take home. Yeah.
Bob. Let me tell you the best thing I ever got from Rich, and I got it a few times, is for Valentine's Day, he would send his clients a beautiful bouquet, and it would come in a beautiful box, and you take it off, big red satin ribbon, with the roots on it, and purple and green, beautiful bouquet of endive, like roses. So, thank you. I appreciated that every year. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask Allison. Did you ever get a bouquet? You did get a book. But.
I didn't. I'm still waiting for mine.
So
I'm pretty hurt.
I think you're going to pretty soon. It's probably one's on your way before long, but. Allison Harvey, and Allison is chef de cuisine, and she's at Ella's. Before Ella's, she was at Kitchen, and she's also one of the chefs that are putting the big dinner together for the bridge dinner. And Allison, everybody sings your praises, said, boy, we need to get you at the table. And I'm wondering a couple things. When you hear Rich talk about him getting started, Bob and getting the flowers that you're yet to get, but I'm sure you have a great relationship with your farmers too, and know the farmers. And you've had a journey that, I don't know if I've got it all straight, but you've not only been at Kitchen and Ellis, which everybody knows of here, but you also left for a while too. You were in the Bay Area as well. How did that happen? Were you here and left and came back, or were you there to start with and come here?
Well, I actually had a different profession before I got into our crazy industry of the restaurants. I used to play golf, so I played a little professional golf. I went to college, did that thing, and moved home after that, and then I decided to get into culinary scene, and I went to culinary school in San Francisco, fell in love with it, spent 12 years there, and moved back to the area. I was born and raised, I was raised in Grass Valley.
You didn't say 12 years in school.
No.
Because I know some do that.
So I started my cooking career in San Francisco, and then after 12 years about that, decided to move home. I needed to change pace. Most of you that know my story, it was really about moving home and getting clean and sober. And that's part of my story. So moving back here and being connected in my community that I have that continues to grow got me on the right path. You know, it's interesting to be part of an industry that has so much destruction. Mentally and physically, and still be so obsessed with it in kind of all the right ways, you know. So this industry also has saved me. So a little bit side note on that one.
Yeah, I'm curious, in that transition when you came back to Sacramento, was Sacramento what it is today yet, or was it becoming, or did you see a glint in your eye and say, this is going to be something great here, or been surprised?
That move for me was a move I fought for years. Why would I leave like a food mecca, like San Francisco, where I was successful and, you know, I worked at 3 Michelin star restaurants, and now I move back home to Grass Valley that is the size of like a pea. And little did I know that when I was going to the farmers markets in San Francisco and being a little naive, that most of my produce was coming from here. And I think sometimes that does get overlooked with a lot of the chefs in San Francisco. But when I moved here, I mean, I didn't have the mindset I have now. You know, I wanted to move back, and now I don't ever want to leave. And my roots are here, and I'll open a place here. But it is definitely, I think, growing and changing in every possible way. And that happens every day. It happens with us, not only as chefs, but people that are in our community.
You know, you're in a unique position this particular week because we have a woman chef that's leading the effort, Suzette Gresham. Some of you listen to my podcast know we had her on as a guest. And she put together a team of women chefs, which doesn't happen that often. I mean, oftentimes it's men that are identified out front, and that's why to see Suzette leading the charge. And she speaks really highly of you and your other three colleagues that are making up this team. So how does that feel, that team? And again, I'm stumbling around because I'm not quite how to word it, that it should be that special, that there'd be a team of women chefs, but it is pretty unusual.
I think it's very special to us, and I think it's special to us not just because it's women, but the fact that we've had a lot of amazing things happen here and in Sacramento for our food industry. To be led by Chef Suzette, and I might be pretty biased because, you know, she walked me down last weekend when I got married. So she's like my culinary mom. But what she is teaching us, and I think it really is kind of like the footprint and how we should approach our food, is very just simplicity. And, you know, the best thing that we can do for farmers as chefs is take take their product, one, have obviously integrity and respect, and do very minimally to it. And that takes a lot of skill for us to be like simple. Well, we want to add this, we want to add that. But that is one of the things that is very different this year instead of previous years. I did this 3 years ago, and it's definitely challenged me in many ways. Like, how do you take an eggplant, where, you know, we harvested 250 eggplant this morning out at Azolla, and how do I make this perfect and make it taste like eggplant, you know, and not add everything else? So, you know, we are being challenged in many ways, which I think is fantastic for everybody involved.
So when you're putting your eggplants and everything together right now, are you working with your normal farmers, or part of your that you're working with, or are these other farms, different farms that you're working with now than you typically do?
No, I mean, for me, and I think everybody that is involved, you know, we have a few new farmers, and that's what that's about, is how can we take maybe small incubator farmers and get them involved with something that is, you know, very, very prestigious in our community, but then you have the other larger small farmers. You know, we wouldn't go to, I think right off the bat, we are very intentional about who we included with the farmers. You know, we want to include farmers that are smaller, that maybe people don't realize, whether that is up in Newcastle or up in Grass Valley or things like that. So, you know, we're kind of spreading it all around the best that we can.
Santana Diaz, Santana, I didn't have you on the earlier card. I'm really glad you could join me, because Santana has done so much in the area. Many of you have perhaps heard him speak before, because he's doing some really interesting things with UC Davis, the hospital system and everything, that they are finding out that they, in fact, can source more locally, not 100%. But it's quite a story, and you're spreading that word. But I'm going to back in to your role, and I'm going to ask Bobbin to kind of comment on that as well. But on some of the things they're running into in the early years before you got involved with UC Davis. But explain, because I can't do justice to what you're doing with the whole system and sourcing. If you could explain what you're doing, what you're trying to do, and this whole vision that you're putting together for UC Davis.
Well, you know, I'm just one individual, right? So, and I like to say it takes a team, takes support, right? So in order for these things, this vision, if you will, you know, I'm pushing for something larger for our community, using food, using health, using the nutrition side of things. You know, we can all attest to hospital food and it not having the best reputation. And so why can't we just change that? Why not? Can we look at that and say, well, how do we get to these points? Is it all because of the dollar? In most cases, yes. You know, farm to fork program, we as culinarians will put it takes a little bit more skill. More hands-on, so you're talking about labor costs on top of the food costs. But if we could put that aside and talk about what the real cost is, as we look at what is considered to be more cost-friendly or foods that are how we've all been trained and how things have been marketed, that sales are great, you know, buy this, it's on clearance, this item that's cheaper is better for you. Really, in the long run, with respect to food, I don't think that's really true. The cost that we are expecting, or that we're probably all anticipating to pay in the long run, whether it's with respect to our health, I think we can all say if we ate fried French fries or fried food every day, three times a day, we'd end up with some kind of health problem, right? So something should be kind of noted there, that what you're actually consuming is actually important towards your health, right? So if we take a look at all these farmers that we have in this geographic region, it's phenomenal to figure out how we can support them and help them grow by giving them the information that they need. So when you look at an institution like UC Davis Health and the scale of what we're able to order, and we can forecast that out, give those numbers to our farmers, and say, I mean, you could tell me, Rich, if this would have helped you, say, 10 years ago, if I said, okay, we need every week 400 pounds of endives. Would that not help your business model and help you grow in the future? So, but how many institutions were doing that for you? Zero. So these are really important things that still to date, I mean, is that even happening now? Yeah, so the opportunity to help the farmers, you know, it doesn't matter about the distribution and how we receive food as chefs to our locations. If we can actually just support the farmer, they'll actually win in the end, and so our community can start dictating the market versus our market that's been dictating cheaper foods and all these other high-processed items. You know, it's just a deeper message. And UC Davis Health has been actually very supportive in that, which is the whole reason why I'm there.
Well, Bob, and you knew Santana before he was over at UC Davis.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted, well, it's in my head, talk about this. So what he's saying is that he's very intentional about what he's doing, right? So that you know how what normally goes on in every kitchen every night is about 11 o'clock, these guys are going to start cleaning up, and they're going to start looking at stuff, just going the walk-in, opening boxes, and they're making a list, checking it twice. About 11:30, maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock when they're ready to get out of here, they're going to pick up the phone and they're going to call the produce company, and the produce company is going to have a recording on it. And they are going to say, I need a box of cucumbers, 6 boxes of tomatoes, I'll take 2 corn. That's how every chef does it. And that's commodity buying. And that's how we've all done it for many years. In our community, really starting, we've been doing this, you know, at least 20 years that we've been focusing on agritourism and knowing our farmers, is we had a blessing of having a produce company who a chef went to work for. All y'all know about Jim Mills, how much we love Jim Mills. He was the crankiest chef you ever wanted to know at Perigary's when he was there. He was just cranky. But what he did is he wanted to know, how do I get this food to me? Because Randy kept saying, I want that stuff in the field on our table. So he finally said, I'm going to go take a job with these guys. I'm going to figure it out. So what they did, which was the blessing that changed the games, is he, as a chef, figured out, oh, that farmer only grows that time of year. And that guy grows that time of year. And that guy, so they figured out the distribution and to telling the chefs and bringing us a box 3 weeks ahead of time to say, hey, Rich has got this coming out of his field. Can you use these little baby asparaguses right now? Yeah, we'll take that. Now what happens, and they made Suzanne Ashworth at Del Rio Farms her cherry tomatoes the default tomato. That's how it started. That was the gateway drug for the chefs. All we're going to say is you just say you need cherry tomatoes, and you're always going to get Del Rio Farms. Then they start recognizing Del Rio Farms. So now here's how it goes. 12:30 at night, chef rings up. He goes, hey, I'll have a full belly. I'll have 2 cases of potatoes, Full Belly Farms. I'd like some of that cape, you know, that olive oil up there at Seike. They will call, just like you call your liquor. You get well, that's commodity. You start calling your farms, then they can produce, they're going to sell more, right? And you're not going to be buying stuff from Texas, from Florida, from Mexico, from Chile, because we're calling the farms that are here. And it was a big education part on the chef's part to take on that challenge. And then as the restaurateurs part in the front of the house was for us to make sure that those names got on our menu. They're our rock stars, because that's how we're educating our clients that here's who those farmers are. Why is that important to me? Because I'm in sales. I got to sell that $28 chicken, right? I can't sell a commodity chicken breast for that. But if someone knows, oh, it's Mary's chicken. Oh, she's sustainable. Oh, and they full belly potatoes. They start understanding that He's got 4 interns on his farm right now. He's got farm workers, delivery drivers, distributors. That there's a lot of money has to come out of that $26 chicken.
You know, Rich, when you hear these chefs talking about the farms and the farmers, and that this coming together, and what I was thinking was that you've helped mentor many young farmers. You've been in an organization that's done it. You do it personally. You're still doing it today. Many of them just really want to be able to make a living farming. Maybe they're changing careers and they're wanting to get farming. But I don't know how many of them come to you and say, I want to be a rock star. And you hear Bobbin, you know, and Allison and Santana saying that, you know, they've come to view them as rock stars. Can you help farmers get ready for that kind of role? Because a lot of times farmers are a little reticent. They're not necessarily, you know, boisterous, go pound on the door, brag about what they're doing. I mean, you prepare them to be rock star farmers.
No, I don't. I just try to give them a good dose of reality. I consider the kitchen where you guys work to be a crazy, crazy domain. Perhaps the next craziest is a field in which to produce food as opposed to preparing it. Just because of the complexity of the arena in which we operate as farmers is mind-boggling. And I don't know how many young farmers are at least initially aware of that with regards to weather and insects and disease and maturity rates and off types or client demands or employees or irrigation schedules, things like that. It's a tough way to make a living. I would say, though, a great element of my career, and I would say today, is when we have chefs and food service operators like this, it just takes a little bit of a level of risk and burden off of that job. And I never promoted to consumers per se, because it's way too much energy, way too much money, and for a relatively small benefit. But I always focused in my career on chefs, because if I could connect with a chef and put a face with that box of endive, and then they would order perhaps not only that week, but then they would order again the next week and the next week, the next week, and those 40 box orders, although rare. You know, at one point, we sold 40 boxes of endive a week to Chez Panisse. 40 boxes a week to one restaurant. Now, albeit a rather unique restaurant. But I always thought to myself, if I had another 10 restaurants in America that could order 40 boxes a week, woo, I'd be living large. So it's just a tough business, and I think this connection, though, with chefs who care, and ultimately consumers, I would say consumers who care, because you can't pull anything over really your customers' eyes. They have to be open to at least the story and the product. That is a dream. That is an absolute dream for a farmer. I call consumers the suppliers of demand. And when you have demand out there, you're in good shape.
So we're going to talk about the dream now. Because at some point, somebody had a dream that this area was different than other areas. And to hear you all say it, it is. Makes me think that I wonder if, as a chef, you said, okay, you've got to move to Indianapolis, now you're going to go be a chef in Indianapolis. And, I don't know, it would be different. I'm sure you could make a difference there. But we are getting out there and claiming we are different. That this area, Sacramento, the farmers, the chefs, the attitude all comes together. And it comes together to allow us to have, some say, the audacity to say we're the farm to fork capital. But, you know, if you feel that way, step up. Bobbin, they haven't always felt that way. When did this come to life that people said, okay, we need to step up and lay claim to this?
Well, I'm sure there's lots of versions of this, so here's my version. I remember I moved to town pretty much permanently around 80, 81, and I started cooking for Joan Lineke at that time. And our city, it seemed like first our city wanted to be, people called us a cow town, and all we are is a stop if you're on your way to either Reno, Tahoe, or Napa, or San Francisco. Great place to stop, great place to stop, great place to stop. But we're more than that, and as it turned out, we're not a federal town. Even though we built some federal buildings and we are the capital, we are not a government town. The people who work here live in the suburbs and come down to here, so it left our downtown empty. Just, you could shoot a cannon through this place for so many years. Then we decided we were a tech company. We're going to be tech. We're bringing all these tech people here. Well, guess what? They went to Folsom and Roseville, right? Hewlett Packard and Intel when they came 20 years ago, 30 years ago. My daughter was and before you were born, I was bidding on gigs for Intel, now that I think about it. So again, nobody was down here, and we lost it. And then maybe a few years ago, which was really cool, we had a brandathon, and it was a last-minute pop-up brandathon. 200 community leaders all went out to the a hangar out at the jet place at the airport, and they had paper and teams, and we all decided, what are we? And it kind of was coming up to the same thing. We're someplace to be before you go someplace else. But the truth is, we are a cow town. We're an agricultural town. That is really how we started. It is our roots. We were embarrassed by it. I think the blessing for me is that my father lived here my whole life, but my mother lived in the San Joaquin Valley in a small farming town. So I really knew what a cow town was. And I'm like, oh no, this is so much better here. And I think that once we decided to claim it, let's just claim it. I mean, you're just saying farm to fork capital of the United States. I'm thinking of the galaxy. I mean, this really is it. You don't have, there's only like three places in the world that have this, what do you call this, Appalachia, this Appalachia, this climate, right? And it's a blessing. We have so much right around us, and we finally really did truly embrace it. But more than just embracing it was educating ourselves about what it really meant to be farm to fork.
Was there a dinner or something where, you know, you could see like a light went off? I don't know if anybody's getting ideas right now, but you say like, aha, I get it.
Okay, this is just small, but here's where I got it. I never dated a chef my entire career. In fact, it's a pretty good piece of advice, I'm going to say, in general. I worked for the Convention Center for 9 years, and by the way, trying to pitch farm to fork and changing that concept from what they used to do to a high-end caterer who was going to buy locally and had a national convention center company, Volume Service, who has 30 convention centers across the country, all into numbers and points, and you chefs know what it is to work for corporate, and you got to keep, you know, your food cost here and that. They made the commitment to let Sacramento freestyle it and start buying local. So for me, that was a big change that we could start, you know, seeing how that worked. But then one day this big messy chef walks into my office and I'm like, how the heck did he get past the receptionist? And I might have said, hey, the kitchen's down the hall to the left and the parole board bus is picking up on the loading dock. I don't know, something like that. But he was inviting me to a pig roast. And I remember it was March and I had files up to here. I was a single mother. And he goes, I want you to come to my pig roast. And I said, well, who's going to be there? And he goes, oh, all the chefs in town. I'm like, thanks for the warning, dude. Yeah, I haven't had a day off in 3 weeks. I haven't spent time with my daughter. So I didn't go. And I didn't go the next year, which, by the way, I still get grief for this. I finally went to one. And guess what I realized? We are a cow town. Patrick got a pig from a farmer, got some other farmers to, hey, give me a case of this, a case of that, and he has a pig roast in the parking lot. Now, we finally quit doing them about 6 years ago when social media really got too big and it was 500-600 people all out and around here and we didn't know anybody anymore and it stopped being an industry thing. But I think when I saw that it was about the chefs and about us, and it was about really truly food. That was my turning point. It was in a parking lot at the Marctuary over on 23rd when Patrick was working out of the basement of the old Marctuary at 23rd and J.
Well, I mean, it was political too. I mean, to a stage. I mean, back when you started to paint over water towers and things. So, I mean, that's...
Food grows on trees.
We used to be the city of trees.
Yes.
And they kind of... And that some people haven't gotten over that fact yet, I suppose.
We still are a city of trees. It's just that a lot of those trees grow food on them. So they need to just embrace farm to fork and all those trees with food on them.
Okay, well, I'm with you. Santana, you got involved with this before you were with the UC Davis Health Program, but and not at the very beginning, I believe, of the Farm to Fork Festival. I mean, when you started getting engaged, how did you connect with it? And were you a little bit looking at it askance that their ambitions were kind of big at the time? I'm just curious what that would have been like walking into it once it was kind of getting on its feet.
Well, I grew up about 30 miles north of here in Yuba City. So I came from a rancher town. It's an agricultural town. But I didn't have the privilege of being involved in, say, the Tower Bridge dinner from its inception. You know, like Chef Brad over there and, you know, with Chef Patrick Mulvaney and the crew that did that those first years. I got involved... set 2007, two years ago, right? So it was a little inviting. We decided to go ahead and be a part of that. I was always involved with food. My family still owns to date hog ranches and cattle ranches in Mexico. When my uncle and my mom, and we all moved up here, I'm the first generation born here in America. We had a farm out here off of Riego Road, 99, right? So tubers, right? So we were doing tubers there, and but this is where that we lost that farm. The commodity pricing and things of that nature, I mean, you couldn't compete. And the cost just, it doesn't work. And I think that's why it's connected a lot to this and to what is that? Rich mentioned... But if you read between the lines, he mentioned economics. He said risk, right? You heard the words demand, right? Supply, all those things. So when you look at this and try to use something like, say, that how I see the Tower Bridge Dinner and the Farm to Fork Festival and things, it's about educating the public. If we don't know what we don't know, then we don't know that what we're buying is maybe not good, right? So... You know, so if you use a platform like the Farm to Fork Festival, you brand a city, America's Farm to Fork Capital. You have the clout and the support to do it. You have the farmers to back it up. It's not just hearsay or talk. This city walks the walk with that. So a prime example about education and how marketing takes that kind of thing away with, because food doesn't seem to be that important. Everybody in the room here of like Delta asparagus knows that it grows in our Delta and all that, you know, and we hear about Delta asparagus. Oh, it's, you know, springtime, right? Does anybody know how many farmers there are left in the Delta that actually grow asparagus and why that is, right? It comes down to the demand, right? You could say it's about water. You could say about all kinds of things, right? But if, say, Rich was a farmer and he's growing asparagus, but he doesn't have an end seller, and, oh, cherry season pops up and the cherry farmers need to pick that stuff right away, and they pay the workers, the laborers, a little bit more money, he's not sure if he's going to sell that asparagus. And the workers are going to go follow the money. So without an end buyer, he's left with all that asparagus crop that has to be hand-cut that will just... He takes it as a loss. What is his family going to do, right? Well, if you're fiscally sound, you know, to any sense right there, and you know that what it takes to be a farmer and to make that happen, why would you risk growing more asparagus next year? You know, if you got to feed your family the next year, I'm not sure, you know, what your wife would say about that and all that influence and everything else. But I mean, I know my wife would be like, what are you doing if I'm just repeating the same thing over and over? That's insanity, right? So when you think about that model, that's been going on in our area for years. Delta asparagus, I think we're down to 2 farmers. For a whole region that was known for that. And what does that mean? That means that we start importing next year. So we import a product that we used to be known for, right? Can we educate our people of this city the importance of food, the healthy side of it? Let's throw sustainability in there because it's in our backyard. I mean, a lot of these institutions are purchasing rice from across the ocean. Why is that when 90% of the rice that's exported out of Sacramento, I mean, it's grown here?
You know, I'm going to try something on that because I know somebody that grows asparagus in Mexico now, and they did grow asparagus outside of Stockton. And they went to Mexico because of the labor cost. And they can sell the product and make a profit out of it coming out of Mexico. But then it gets back to the demand. Does anybody say that there's something that's special about the asparagus we do grow here? That other than just the price. And that's where I see something like Farm to Fork, is that you're drawing attention to the fact that it's more than just what's the absolute cheapest of a commodity production, industrial style agriculture. And that's the one thing, Allison, I see that they're doing, and you're helping do. When I talked to Suzette, I think she might have even said this on the air, she said that she took everybody, they went, all went to lunch at Ellis, and she was so happy with it. She was so impressed. But she was observing, too, that the production here, the farmers here, the products here, it's more than just looking at what's the cheapest today, but there is some value in it. Do you sense that when you're dealing with your customers that come to Ellis and having a wonderful meal, that they appreciate the sourcing, that you're, you know, not simply getting the cheapest commodity you can find?
Absolutely. I think I really ran into that when I was at the kitchen. That was part of the story. That's how we incorporated our menu and our products, and that's how we made our menu was, well, I can source a peach that is a very unique variety, an Indian peach that I can only get from one farmer that's up in Newcastle at Twin Peaks. And then you tell that story that is behind it, and you're like, you won't get this peach anywhere else, and you can only get it here, and we are the only restaurant that gets it. And so it creates this, this story, therefore, lends into education. But before that, that requires us as chefs to create what I believe is the most important relationship that we have in our industry, and that is with our farmers. You know, and the time that we spend with them walking their fields and understanding it, and you know, understanding, you know, how they, you know, they lost a crop or something like that. So it is part of what we do, and I encourage that story to be told, you know, definitely with my staff that are new staff. Well, why are we getting this? Why aren't we getting it from here? What's so special about this? We talk about it. We have the farmer come in and talk to our staff, and we educate our front of the house. They're there to do a lineup, and you know, so it's taking pride and it's taking ownership.
You know, I don't get to use the word milieu very often. You know, so I'll give you so it's M-I-L-I-E-U, milieu. But it's like this clump of people that come together, and they're much more than the sum of the parts, and there's something special that happens. I think we got it here. You're identifying it. We're still articulating it. We still have some people perhaps that are skeptical. But I want to ask the audience now, if before we quite wrap up on this side and get back to some more snacking and banjo fiddle, does anyone have any questions for knowing that there is actually a potential book in it for you? There we go. Brad, you beat the lady here, just barely.
So my question's for Rich, you know, and there are documentaries and things out there in the world that talk about sustainable farming and how that affects, you know, generations of people. But from a chef perspective, I'm a chef. How do chefs, because we often talk about, like, it's tomato season, right? Like, can I buy all your tomatoes? Santana's changing the world, right? I love you. I love you, Santana. But you are changing the world in the economics of how food is sourced, right? Every pork gizzard you buy to feed poor hospital, you know, patients lowers the cost of pork tenderloin for all of us small restaurateurs, right? That's the reality of economics of farming. So how do chefs support, when you grow endive or blackberries or whatever, there's off seasons for that. You don't gather that cash flow throughout the year. So how do chefs and restaurateurs and consumers support farmers the rest of the time?
Well, it's in the endive business, we were able to produce year round. So I used to say we produced endive 53 weeks out of the year. We made all of our money in the last week. So, because that's the nature of the business, it's a tough business. But to be there on a consistent basis, and I would say also, you know, we threw away a lot of endive in my career because it didn't look just right, or it was too small. And when we first started, we started selling baby endive, not as a luxury item or a exclusive item, you know, baby vegetable. We discounted it to entice chefs to be not afraid of the price. So it's just to have an understanding of what's coming out of the field, what the grade is, what the volumes are, means a lot to a farmer, because if you're real persnickety about a certain type of product, and those types of clients are out there, and I always loved placating them, because that meant if I could make them happy, everyone would be happy. Didn't happen very often, though. So just to know that food production is not perfect, and if you can take some off grades or take a big slug of stuff and do some of your own preserving, just to have that working knowledge of what a farmer is up against with regards to those unknowns and those variables, it means a lot to a farmer. Especially coming from a chef who can make a difference because of the volumes that a chef can you know, reasonably procure versus a consumer.
Thanks, Brad. Brad, you get a book.
Yes.
Yeah, all right. And you're next.
Hey, Roger. I have a point about that one, is that one thing a lot of chefs around the country, and then specifically here the last few years, especially since all our farmers started sending all the good stuff to San Francisco for their farmers market, all the pretty fruit, we literally told the farmers, give us your ugly stuff. We do not care. We're chopping it up. So that is one way I think that the farmers have been able to, it was a kind of a weird thing for a couple of years. First we were mad, and then we're like, yeah, okay, we don't want to spend that top dollar for that also. And then one more thing, because I think that this topic that these two are talking about is so important that I just want to add one more piece to this. We keep telling how we have to keep educating ourselves and we have to educate our clients. So I'm going to tell you something I got educated about 4 years ago. I was at a Chef's Collaborative conference in Boulder, and I will never forget this Neiman farmer came up, big old cowboy hat on stage with 300 chefs in the audience, and he says, well, I don't know why I should invest in growing that next year. I'm going to take 5 years before it gets online, and all you guys are going to want is the ribeye out of it, and I don't even know if I should do it. And he kind of like sucked the wind out, because I know every other person, he goes, you can't guarantee me you're going to buy it from me. And we're all thinking, there's no guarantee I've got a customer. There's no guarantee I'm open in 5 years. What are you talking about? You want me to guarantee your cow? We can't do that. But what we can do is stop cherry picking. Us as chefs stop cherry picking, and you guys stop cherry picking eating, because there's all kinds of parts. I appreciate you making the comment about the gizzards, because that's what we're talking about, right? And the chefs the same way get so easy. I got a pork chop, I got a loin, I got this, I got that. That's commodity buying. But a good chef is going to say, man, I got to get that menu cheaper. You know what? I'm going to make something with skirt steak this week. I'm going to use that oxtail. I'm going to use these parts of the cow so the farmer doesn't have to take the good cherry pick piece out and run the wet rest through a meat grinder and make hamburger for some outlet someplace. So it, on your part, might want to ask for different cuts of meat to encourage that and to help that market out.
Point. Then you're next.
So I'm not a chef. I'm just inspired by the panel. You guys inspire us every time we come to your restaurant, so thank you for that. I have two questions. You make me want to eat endive. Just let's be real. And so what is your favorite recipe that's just quick and easy for a home chef? And then while you're marinating on that answer, I wanted to ask Bob, and you had said that Sacramento has its specific climate and all the things around us to be grateful for. You said it's one out of three. What are the other two places?
Off the top of their head, it is like it was Persia. It's someplace like that is one of them. Where is the other one? I'm gonna look it up. And my friend, is it Italy? I bet you $100 it is. Very similar client as us as well. Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have done the research before I said it. But we're really blessed, and we don't even realize that we have the cool breeze coming in from the Delta, right? There's just all these special things about the... And then the terra, which our young farmers know about that, our dirt. Our dirt is rich, and we're blessed with that.
Endive-wise, I would say in a good winter salad with a vinaigrette with rice vinegar and blue cheese, roasted walnuts, and a kumis or Anjou pear. And if you're into cooking, there's a dish called endive au jambon, which is a Flemish dish, actually, which is steamed endive wrapped in ham and baked in a bechamel sauce with a Gruyere or a Comté cheese on top. That's good living.
Yes!
That sounded delicious. Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm from the table over there. We're all recent graduates of the California Farm Academy. So I found the discussions really interesting tonight, and I just wanted to share a story with you. During our training, we met several of the incubator farmers, and one young lady was producing this beautiful, you know, vegetables, all sorts of vegetables and fruits, and I asked her, I said, where are you selling these? And she said, I'm not sure yet. I have to find buyers. And it just occurred to me that she was having a hard time finding where to sell her produce. It was organic, it was beautiful. And what do you think is the best way to approach chefs? And how do you plan what to grow? If she's sitting there coming up with the crop plan for next spring, how does she know what you need?
Thank you. I'm a huge supporter of the CFA. Mary Kimball's fantastic. So my first year at the kitchen, I specifically went to Mary and I said, I need sunchokes, because I'm a month out for my next menu, who can you point me in the direction? And, you know, you just had a graduating class. So she gave me a name, I went out and I met this gentleman. And he, with the kitchen, let me give you a little further background on that. To like the day and the week, we knew how much we would be going through. You know, based down to obviously our proteins and our garnishes. Well, basically what we did is I ended up buying him out for the whole month, and he supplied. And I made it a point, sure, you could come up and drive to me, but I actually want to come out and pick up from you, and I actually want to harvest with you. So that's a really cool story. And so we try to do that every month, at least have one incubator farmer, because you guys are just starting out, and that's important to us. And if you got your name at the on the kitchen menu, I'd say you're doing pretty well. Also, us as chefs, we hate what we call cold calls. That means we have like fish purveyors that stop in. They stop in at really shitty times too. It's like 12:30 or it's 5:30. And it's just like, we have a full restaurant and you want to talk about what you have. I will tell you this, we don't turn away cold calls from farmers. And most of our farmers that we use, they come straight off the farm. They are in their Carhartts, they are muddy, they are dirty, and they walk in our back door and they drop off the delivery in our walk-in, or they come and they find us in the back. We like that. So pitch it to us. You know, we can't always go out and try to find you guys. So I encourage you, reach out to Mary, and she will point you in the right direction. I can assure you that. And if she doesn't, I will give you my card, and we will help circulate what you guys are trying to produce and bring into our restaurants. But that's how we work as a community. Okay?
And I'll just touch on that from a different perspective. It's way different for a hospital. But I can speak from the restaurant side, and maybe hopefully Brad won't get too upset on this one. I would suggest for those farmers, the small incubator farmers, the 1 acre, 2 acre, 5 acres, before they plant things, why don't they find the demand of who's going to buy it too? Go to the chef and say, I would like to grow some things. What would you like? Because if you switch it around, the chef has to figure out what's going to sell on the menu. It doesn't matter how exotic or whatever vegetable you're growing, if, again, the education side of it, the public doesn't even know what it is. So it doesn't matter. It's called, you know, Venus whatever, tomatoes from whatever. My point is that the name, if what you're growing, it could be great. But he's got to educate, the restaurant's got to educate the public. And how much time do they have to educate the public? You, the diner, are there for your own experience, right? You're having you're celebrating your meal. You're having your party, whatever. So how much time does a server really have to educate you on all this stuff? So it's a give and take relationship. You know, that's like, I mean, it's trying to say, here, I got all this stuff. You want to buy it? You know, it's like, well, no, because he already planned his menu out 3 months before, right? So that's kind of where that would come from. So if you're really looking for a relationship, that's where that would start. And then you can grow things together.
Hi, thanks for all your wisdom tonight. And my question is this. I don't know if this figure is still accurate, but I remember reading that only 2% of what's grown in the region is consumed in the region. Because you can go to the Bay Area and sell for a lot more. You can go to the restaurants and all that. And my concern is, even if we could increase demand in the lower income community and, you know, not just give farm to every fork to Yolo County, but bring it into Sacramento, where's the capacity? How can we, is there the capacity for farmers to grow enough that the prices would then be affordable for folks throughout the city and not just in the downtown corridor?
I don't know that I'm the right one, but I don't see anyone else wanting to jump in on this one. And there are probably a couple people in this room that are really smart about this. I mean, you are, but I have an opinion about it. And it's somewhere between 2 and 4, and that's true. We grow a boatload of stuff here, dude. We're only so many people. That's a whole different topic about getting it where you need to get it. But there's no shame in that we only use 2%. We grow a lot of food. So that, to me, keeps getting used in the wrong way. You have an issue. That's true. Not you. You're trying to fix the issue. We have an issue that you've been working on for many years, and I hope that we can alleviate those food deserts because the food is around. But the truth is, it's not because we're lazy, or it's just that we grow a lot of food, so the percentage is small.
I'll touch on that too from Golden One Center. So the 90% source of the 150-mile radius program for there, we were sourcing 80% of the produce within 150-mile radius. UC Davis Health's hospital program right now, is trending over 45% local and sustainable spend, with 65% of all produce coming in from a 150-mile radius. Those are huge numbers for these areas, right? So 2% can be, like it sounds like a small number, but we sustain at our venue, we do 6,500 average meals a day. That's over 40,000 a week. Every day we never close. So that 65% that is sustaining on local purchasing and procurement of produce, and we do bring in endives, and we do bring in the Coraline and things of that nature, but that's, we just grow a lot of stuff in this area, you know, so it's we're trying.
Yeah, Brad?
Sorry, I when Santana says something like that, like the what that means to a lot of what's going on is like when UC Davis Health sources that much from the local economy, everything that does for small local restaurants, it drives down the price. Like the guarantee of the fact that like Santana is guaranteeing these people and farmers and growers the fact that he's going to buy that much food, 40,000 meals a week, it changes the economy of what happens in local restaurants, because he's doing things that guarantee farmers a livelihood, and that matters. So he won't say it, but it is a big deal. So,
well, you know. Would you like to say? Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, my name is Alexa. I'm a recent graduate from the CFA Beginner Farmer Training Program, and my question is there opportunity? What advice would you give, or how would you go about bridging the gap between the farmers and the chefs? That whole connection, rather than just leaving it up to either the farmer to reach out to the chefs or the chefs reach out to the farmers. Rich, I understand you have some experience. I believe you said Brad. Somebody sparked it up in the 80s or 90s, getting exactly the availability lists from the farmers, giving that information over to the chefs and the restaurant to better organize it. That's something I'm interested in just from hearing this talk. I have 8 years of hospitality industry experience, so now that I'm switching over to the careers, I would just like to learn more about that gap between chefs and farmers, especially within this region, which seems to be getting closer.
I would say that gap is pretty dang narrow. And I can tell you, when I started, the Google machine didn't exist. And, you know, there was no web. And, I mean, it was knocking on doors. And, I mean, I schlepped so many boxes of endive around to restaurants. And whenever there were two or more chefs in one place, it was like manna from heaven for me, because I didn't have to work as hard, because it was a total educational experience for me to educate chefs about endive. So I think today the tools are perhaps, I don't do social media. I've never been on Facebook or any of those other ones. It might even be overwhelming because there's so much information out there. But when I started, there was a dearth of information. I mean, nobody had information. It was really tough to move it around. But there was a nascent movement back in the late 70s, early 80s, where people started getting interested. Some producers got interested in doing certain types of products, but also there were chefs and consumers who were interested in using those products. So I think the interest is the key point, not necessarily the medium in which those interests connect or are communicated. But I don't know about today's modern technologies, quite frankly. But there's always an interest, I think, from good chefs to know about the provenance of their products. And there's always an interest on farmers' parts to be able to share what's involved in the production of that food. So when you can get those two connections made, however you do it, one-to-one or on social media, it can't hurt. It just can't hurt.
That's a really good question, actually. And I, too, do believe that that gap that you're talking about is getting smaller and smaller. And it's really exciting to go from San Francisco to here. That gap's actually pretty big in San Francisco. And it's wonderful that we're a different community here. We're a community that definitely helps each other out. And that was one of the largest things that I noticed when I moved here. It's where it's so integrated, and that's really amazing. And yes, you do have social media that can help you get your foot in the door, but also coming in and visiting us, I really truly do believe that human interaction goes a long way, more than what social media can do. And we don't have a lot of time, you know, yes, most of us are on social media, but I want to meet you. You know, I want to see the passion that you have inside of you in your eyes, and I want you to pitch it to me. Tell me why. Tell me why I should start using your stuff. That's it.
We got time for just one more question. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Bob.
I got a quick one for you because I was raised on a farm. I understand it. I've been in marketing, selling food for a long time, and so it's all about relationships, and that's it. It doesn't matter. So I got to tell you, because my daughter is 30 years old and kicking the market now, she is probably out 3-4 evenings, days a week, going to functions like this. Keep your eye on Women in Food and Ag. Some in your group have. Cindy has. And show up and meet them. When we just did 200 people up at Twin Peak Orchards with, gosh, I don't even know, we probably had 40, 50 women volunteering and cooking and waiting tables and bringing their product in. And so that's how you build relationships, is that you show up, right? The product is all great, but it really is about our personal relationships.
If you don't know, ask us. We will absolutely
agree. Watch Valley Vision. They do some nice farm-to-fork things. There's all kinds of really cool, inexpensive and collaborative things like this that we can do together, just like the bridge dinner. Gosh, who's doing staffing? How many people are you going to have out on that bridge? Back of the house.
Back of the house is set up right now. We're well over 100. So 100 culinary
in the
back
the
of
front.
The house.
Yeah.
And then that's not even counting the front of the house. In total, it's in the industry, we look at 400 between volunteers and everybody to put on that bridge dinner for 800 plus people. And so it's pretty amazing. If a farmer goes and walks around those areas, you'll meet some people, right?
Yeah. So we get time for one more question, and I'm sorry, but I have a feeling you already have a book, so you're not going to get a book. Is that right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, but actually, I don't think I have a book, Rich.
Oh,
I might have to give you a hard time about that. My name is Donnie Andrack, and you were touching on it here, Allison and Bobbin, and all the way around. And I think the one thing I'd like you to expound upon, I guess each of you a little bit more, is the tag of America's Farm to Fork Capital. It does offer us a sort of unifying theme for all humans. We all have to eat. All humans have to eat. So I think it is an opportunity to educate people about what they're putting in their bodies. I think it is an opportunity to educate people about what the farmers are growing. I did a master's thesis on America's Farm to Fork, and we talk about the commensality. It's when you get people together, it's the eating of the food, but it's also the exchange and people talking together and experiencing that stuff together. Social media is wonderful. I live and die by it for a number of my businesses, but it's not the only thing. Talking to people is really important. So could you speak to that?
Yeah, well, which is why we called our podcast Table Talk, because we thought people should sit down and have conversations like we're having tonight, and that should be what it's about. And you are having this conversation. She asked for each of you to make a quick comment about farm to fork, so we'll wrap up with that. Just this is going to be like the presidential debates, you know, this is the closing statement.
Well, as a farmer, it makes great sense for me. I would say the whole educational aspect. In my Andive career, I had to do a lot of education because people, you know, what is it? How do you pronounce it? How do you use it? Why is it expensive? How do you grow it? Blah, 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 blah. So it's tough to educate. But if you can educate around good food and with good people, it makes it so much easier. A friend of mine who's a teacher described teaching fourth graders as having a birthday party every day for 30 10-year-olds. And you can imagine how exhausting that is. Education is exhausting because you got to be on, you got to say it right, and you do it again, and you do it again and again and again. So when there's a receptive audience and people are interested, for me as a food producer, it is, I think I stated earlier, it's a dream come true because it just makes it a little bit less exhausting.
It's crazy. It is all about education. I also, I'm on the board for Ag in the Classroom, which I absolutely adore. So I get to work a lot with Kids Ag's programs. And what I found about Farm to Fork is that everybody's talking about it and everybody's included in the game. Because again, we all eat. So all of a sudden, people at the nail salon are talking about food. Everybody is an expert on it. And at first I thought, oh, it's just a big marketing campaign. It's going to be hollow. But I was so pleasantly surprised that it couldn't be hollow because it was about something that we all live and breathe here, and that's food. So I think it gives us the opportunity to all speak the same language. And the blessing is that in having that language together, that we can improve our health, that we can teach that you don't just eat the same thing every day of the year. That's why different things come out of the ground at different times, because we need different micronutrients in our bodies. And it's just, it's fun that we're geeks and we get to talk about it with people like you, and that you're interested enough to come out on a Tuesday night.
I eat ice cream every day of the year, not so Farm to Fork there, but maybe it's peach ice cream. But anyways, if something gets through tonight, through this podcast, through this, you know, anything here, we talk about education. Just, I challenge you, every time you buy something that has to do with food, know where it comes from. If you can do that, you're going to educate yourself on a whole nother level. Can you pronounce all the ingredients in whatever you're buying? When you go to the farmer's market, you know, and this is the make you feel good time, like, okay, I'm supporting my local farmer. Remember, that farmer still has extra things they take back. What are they selling? They're selling seconds, which is fine, you know, but the reality of it is, remember why that exists. It's economics. They didn't have an end buyer. They're hoping they're selling it to you. So yes, purchase it.
Go late,
and you'll get the better deals. But the whole thing about transparency, that's what our program is really trying to do, and really try to communicate that educational piece to the general public, is know where your food's coming from. Why is it important for chef to know her farmer, so that we know where it grows and we know what's actually put into it? How many people can say that they know about that and the lettuce that's in your refrigerator right now at home? Right? If we can figure that out, and with blockchain stuff, Brad, I was telling you about, these are big things that are in the works, and just if you do that homework for yourself, you're living that farm to fork life.
I think for me, what I learned a lot about Farm to Fork this year with the Bridge Dinner and being involved was how could I be more involved than I was the past couple of years, or even in the restaurant that we're running. And it was about seeding to harvest and getting out there, seeding with Azolla Farms, understanding, you know, that process. We lost crop, you know, for the Bridge Dinner, and you know, to really kind of live in their world and to understand a part of Farm to Fork that we don't normally see as chefs. You know, if we don't get it, great, we're going to go to another farmer. So it really is embracing all avenues of Farm to Fork, and it is about living it instead of just talking about it, you know, and we all have our own parts in doing it in our community. So
I get so excited about these things. It's great. It's inspiring when you sit and hear people talking and the vision and the questions that we have right now. I want to thank you all. I also want to thank Mulvaney's. I tell you what, every event I've ever been to here has been really top-notch, and the people are great, the food's great, you make us feel welcome, and thank you for hosting this.